I'm not gonna lie, this was a brutal winter, guys, and after a brief spring, we have landed in summer, thank goodness. I'm ready to pack up the sweaters and get out the linen. I want those light fabrics that make us feel good the moment they're on our bodies, and that is why I love my Quince products. Did you know that Quince has elegant, everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at $32? Remember that Quince is 50 to 80% less than similar brands because you're paying for quality, not brand markup. If you haven't checked them out in a while, they're now a destination for home, kitchen, bedding, and beyond. So make sure you get their pieces that bring a premium feeling to everyday life. I am newly in love with my 100% European linen shorts. Something I can wear to the park or dress up. They're thick enough to have some structure, but light enough to feel wearable all summer long. I'll be in mine every week. I have them in black, but there are 11 colors to choose from. There are 4,261 reviews, all averaging 5 stars. Made with European flax and machine washable, I'm going to need another pair. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cheesenotya.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "My story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right: How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Hi, Cece. How are you doing today?
I'm well. It's been a fun week. How about you?
It's been good. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that I am not in my office. I'm in a hotel room. I'm in Toronto. I was here for an author event. So we're recording on the fly. I brought my microphone with me and it's not working. So we're going through my headphones today. We're just flying by the seat of our pants over here.
So the flight from Ottawa to Toronto is super short. Do you pack carry-on or do you check luggage?
Great question. It would always depend on how long I'm going for, generally. Just one night, so I did carry on. The issue is it's a very small plane. And so, it's very hard to like fit, a quote unquote like normal size carry on. So yeah, I just kind of did a duffel bag and here I am. So I'm traveling light for me.
Good for you. I'm going to Aspen in for summer words for the conference. I actually think it's technically Snowmass and not Aspen, but whatever. So I'm going to the conference, right? Like the conference organized by Adrian Brodeur later this month. And there's no direct flights. So you have to go to Denver and then go to Aspen, the Aspen airport. And the connection, my time in Denver is very short. It is very, very short. I don't remember right now, but I'm pretty sure it's like less than an hour. And I'm a checked bag girl all day. Like, I cannot handle carry-on. I need a lot of things. I like to pack my moisturizer. I don't like travel size toiletries. It's just, I like to have options. I'm sure there's a deeper psychological thing going on where I need to have a feeling of plenty to feel safe, whatever. It doesn't matter. But I'm thinking I might try to do carry-on because I don't
Ooh,
want my
that's very bold for
luggage,
you.
but only because I'm pretty sure the luggage is not going to make it on time. Like, if the window's so short, I know sometimes they make it, but like if the plane is even a little delayed, and planes are often delayed, because in Hawaii that happened. Like I did, so I went to Denver and then I flew from Denver to Kauai. And because my flight was delayed arriving in Denver, I had to run to the gate, run to the Denver Kauai gate. And when I got there, one of my suitcases had made it, but the other one had not. Yes, I checked too. So I'm thinking I don't want to go through that again. So there's like two options right now. Either I'll do carry on and just like be a big girl, get over it. Or then option number two is going to be I'll do a carry on situation with like one outfit for the day. And then we'll also check bag because like the bag will arrive eventually, hopefully. I don't know. So Wendy at my agency at Wendy Sherman, she is very good with carry on and she's very stylish. So it is possible to be stylish and pack a carry on. She's like the first person I've met who can do both. Most of the people who tell me they can do a carry-on, I look at them and I go, doesn't seem like you have a lot of shoes, you know?
Or
Like,
you don't care about your big size beauty products, that you spend money on that you want
I'm
with
not
you.
convinced you're like packing a blow dry. I'm just not convinced, which is fine. Like, I'm admirable even, but like we are probably just very different people. Like, look at the size of my moisturizer.
I
It's a big
know.
moisturizer.
My
Anyway.
issue. I know. This isn't a beauty podcast. And we always say one of these days we'll drop the beauty routine if anybody cares. Maybe that will be on our next Substack Live. We'll get
Oh my
into all of
gosh.
that. But yeah, so book stuff. So yeah, so I'm in Toronto for my author's event and it was so good. It was our panel between my clients, Rachel and Harrison, who are siblings that co-authored a book together about gender diverse athletes and gender inclusion in sport. And anyway, it was great. And so they were on a panel with Rachel Reed of Heated Rivalry. And it was just so well done. It was just like one of those like life-affirming events where you're just in person, great conversation, incredible audience. And yeah, anyway, it was lovely. And yeah, it was just kind of just fangirling for them and kind of helping out around the event. And anyway, it was just beautiful and wholesome. I just posted my Instagram carousel of all the wonderful images. And yeah, it's just life-affirming people talking about books, coming out in person, standing in line, making friends in line, and all the wonderful reasons we love books.
Oh, I love that. Author events are the best. Like it's such a special moment. There's so many glimmers in this industry, so many moments that spark joy. This is like top of the list for sure. I'm so happy for you.
I know, I know. So I had on my notes of things to obviously reflect on today, and I like to kind of talk about what's going on the week. One of the things I was thinking about, I don't know if you think about this, of things for us to chat about, was this idea of like, what is our job description? Because I was at the event last night, obviously fangirling for my clients, getting the water on stage. I'm like everything from stage mom to like producer of the event to making sure the books are getting signed and the lines are moved. Like, I don't know. It's just so funny that I think our job takes on so many
different textures, like depending on what environment we're in. And I'm always just thinking about like, what is the core goal is obviously always like client care and making sure that they're having an amazing event. But yeah, I was just trying to think about, you know, if how you imagined this job is my question for you, and has the scope of it changed over the course of you doing it?
This is really a good question. I imagined it before I researched it really differently. I think I had this romantic version in my head of what we see in the movies, what we read about in books that feature publishing professionals, but also just a lot of my own assumptions. You know, oftentimes when we are surprised by something, if you're surprised by something, it's because you had a different expectation. And those expectations sometimes don't actually just come from media. Sometimes it comes from your own imagination and what you want to be true, you know, unconsciously. But this was before I did research. After I did research, I had a very clear understanding because I do think there's a lot out there. This was pre our podcast, but there was still even back then a lot that out there on the realities of the job. And I'm someone who I don't typically do the whole, it's going to be easier than, like, I don't believe that things are going to be easier than they actually are. If anything, I believe they're going to be harder or I'm pretty compatible, you know, like I guessed correctly. So I was very clear eyed when I joined this industry. I knew how hard it was going to be. I knew the, like what you're calling the scope creep, which I think is a great term. Like I knew that was real. And it comes down to the economic realities of it, you know, from a pure economics perspective. In an industry where you have very little competition because there are very few buyers, we use that term oligopsony all the time, which is essentially a way of saying very few buyers, lots and lots of sellers. You know, in an industry like that, it's very common for the burden to be passed on to the creators, meaning the authors. And since we are author advocates, since we are author representatives, and our interests are 100% aligned because we only make money when they make money, we win when they win, a lot of it ends up falling into agents. It's the economics of it, right? So I think things have changed for sure, and they're always changing, and probably they're just going to keep changing more, and we're going to keep absorbing more and more and more. And one thing that you are, like, I have to credit this to you, but you have, since we first started working together, you've been very big on boundaries are the unsung heroes in this industry, right? So you have to decide like what you're going to do, what you're not going to do. There are things that like it is our duty, like our duty as agents, and that's our fiduciary duty. That's, you know, our actual core job description, and that's not optional, of course. But then the extra stuff, like how editorial are you going to be? Like how much are you going to help with whatever it is? And it's important to like manage it in a way that is not just sustainable, but in a way that energizes you. Because the thing is, not all tasks are created equal. You know, if I spend 1 hour going for a walk and drinking a, you know, lemonade on a hot summer day, that hour recharges me. If I spend 1 hour doing something else, that might drain me. So it's about knowing also what tasks drain you and recharge you.
Yeah. I was, so I had breakfast with an agent colleague, and I was talking about that idea of, like how we use our time, and we're so lucky to have what I call like a thinking job. When you're talking about, okay, going for a walk with a lemonade during quote unquote work hours, to me, I'd be thinking about work the whole time. You know, I'd be problem solving things. And so like the work is
in the best way, right?
In the best way, exactly.
Yeah, same. Yes. Same.
Yeah. So it never really leaves us. And so I think the concept of boundaries is important because no matter what, we're always like taking the job home with us. We're taking the work home.
Yeah.
We're editing at night or reading at night or thinking about something or, you know, looking at emails. And that's kind of just the nature of the job. And so if we don't have boundaries that, you know, like I'm not going to look at my email between 5 and 7 p.m. while I'm, you know, having dinner with my family or whatever, like those are the core things that are obviously super important, but we're always working. We're always on. It's not really a job where you're ever off. And again, it's not a bad thing. And this is not supposed to be any sort of series of complaints. I just think about the scope, and I want to get into scope a little bit when we talk about one of the articles that we picked today, because it's just changing all the time. And part of what makes agents good at their job, or good agents good at their job, is that we are being really flexible about scope and how it shows up in different ways. So for example, the article that I want to reference is the article that was called "Nonfiction Book Publishers Aren't Remotely Ready for AI." And it was published in New York Mag, in the kind of like Intelligencer section. written by Charlotte Klein, a features writer, came out on May 20th. And it really, really just iterates what we already know is like how much falls to agents. And when there aren't systems in place, this article is talking about AI and nonfiction and fact checking. And when there aren't systems in place to protect authors from the publisher side of things, it's always going to fall, as you said, Cece, to the agent who is in the middle ground between those two things. And so I thought it was a really interesting article. I'll grab some quotes that I thought were especially important. One of them is, "Some agents and editors are keeping this front of mind as they sign new clients, spending more time vetting writers for their human expertise." This is my favorite quote that I posted on Instagram. "If I'm getting you as the agent, if I'm getting you a six-figure book advance, I don't want you putting it into ChatGPT," said a top literary agent. "Go to the fucking library." I love that quote because, again, as agents, now we have to be like, don't put this into ChatGPT. Don't use AI. Now we have to be the middle person between authors and tech, as well as like the middle person between authors and publishers. I just find us right now in another middle ground where we are fighting the scope creep of having to learn so much about tech that a lot of us who got into the book business never imagined that we would have to ever learn so much about technology and computer science. I certainly didn't think that. And so now I have to be like an expert in copyright law. I have to be an expert in, you know, emerging tech. I don't know. I just feel like the things that are being put on our shoulders just never ends. And in a way where, again, I'm not surprised, this is not complaint, but I'm just wondering out loud, thinking out loud, as we layer all of these things on top of each other, are there things that like agents are starting to let go of in terms of the responsibility? Or do you think that we're always adding things? Does that question make any sense?
Like a mother's heart. Yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah. But it's like a mother's heart. There's always room for more.
It's endless. You know? Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
All, it's like except we'll do whatever. Not kids. We're talking about tasks. So because it is for our author. So no, we keep expanding. We keep expanding. We keep carrying more. And this is why you have to love it. Because when you love what you do, yeah, it's more. But it's more that you love.
Yeah. And it gets me thinking about some things. So this article was focusing on nonfiction, which is why I'm talking about nonfiction. And it gets me thinking about the importance of fact checking. And I feel like we talk about this all the time, how publishers don't pay for fact checking. And so authors of nonfiction are often hiring for fact checking. And a quote from the article said, "Anything that costs money, publishing is allergic to," one agent noted. As usual, I think the onus is going to fall onto authors and agents. And then another quote, they're talking about someone in the article and said his book had 3 rounds of proofreading, but he did not hire a fact checker, something that was never suggested to me by the publisher. And I think fact checking is one of those things that kind of goes unsaid, but I'm like, why does it go unsaid? You know, as an agent, I want my client to.
I mean, I
to,
can tell you why.
Because they don't want to pay for it, so they don't want to bring it up?
Yeah, because if they bring it up, the author could be like, isn't that your job?
Yeah.
And then, you know, there could be like, again, this is very me being myself, but yeah, they could be like, hey, we're partners. We have to split this. Our contract doesn't say that we don't. Yes, usually contracts say that they won't fact check, or at least sometimes they do. But if they say, I'm suggesting you do it, then you are saying it is needed. And if you're saying it is needed, there's a discussion of, well, then why shouldn't we at least split the costs? Or maybe even you do it because I wrote the whole damn book, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then there's the whole negotiation thing of like,
can
you just get more money from the publisher? And like that bucket of that improvement on the advance goes to our paying for the fact checker, right? Like these are all leverage.
But they also don't recommend or suggest hiring publicity, for example. But they want authors to. But they can't recommend it. Like the second they make it a recommendation or even a suggestion, the second they even bring it up.
Deficit. Yeah.
It suggests a deficit and it highlights the inequality. It highlights the imbalance between author and publisher.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, anyway, I thought that was just a really interesting article. Again, not, you know, saying anything that we particularly maybe don't know, but I think it's just really interesting, again, how it highlights the fact that agents have to be the intermediary between all the fact-checking, the AI, kind of making sure that the clients are doing, you know, what they sign their contracts to do, which is write these books themselves. Yeah. Obviously, incredibly important.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have to like acquire new skills as agents all the time. Like, I don't think we have to be experts in all the things, but we do need to have, we need to be fluent in so much. It's a lot of hats. A lot of hats. And I'm talking about my Grinch hat this time, guys. Talking about the cute hats.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the constant upskilling is one of those things that feels good as a professional. Like, you always want to be improving, obviously, on your core skills. But I guess I'm just like, I'm upskilling in ways that I never imagined that I would ever have to on the tech side of things, which is interesting.
But you're good at tech, so... You know,
thank you. That's very gracious. Yeah, I think there's also lots of different ways to upskill as an agent. You know, there's agents who are really helpful on publicity side of things or social media side of things or, you know, events. You know what I mean? Or like some agents are very editorial. Like, is that considered an upskill or is that considered a core skill? Because I consider a core skill the deal making, right? The deal making being... acquiring the client, selling the book, doing the contract, like that, like contracty deal making piece is like what I consider the core skill. And then everything else is an upskill, in my opinion.
I agree. I agree with your opinion. Yeah. Our core job is selling. It's the deal making, like you said. Literally everything else. Like there's actually a really interesting parallel with the entertainment business, right? Like usually in entertainment, you have the agent, but then you also have a manager. Like we do both. You know, we project manage as well. And then we also do the coaching, which is part of the editorial. Like there's a lot, you know, there's a lot that goes into our jobs.
I know. Okay. Well, thank you for indulging me on that, you know, place my brain was going today because I was thinking about that. And it's fun that, you know, and as I said, this is not meant to be any sort of complaint. I like how our job evolves and I feel like it's always an interesting challenge and it's great.
Yeah. Evolve, adapt or die.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So let's get to our first question. So this was from, I believe, the form that we have set up now, which is, hi, Carly and Cece. I have a question. I'm drafting my novel. I know I should start building my platform now, but I'm struggling to identify the topics around which to create content that would translate into eventual readership. If I'm willing to hire a professional to help me get some clarity, what type of consultant should I consider engaging to help me determine this? Am I looking for a freelance publicist or someone else? Thanks so much. This was funny because this question came in, and then I also saw a really good Substack on this topic. So I kind of want to partly answer the question, but then I want to kind of get into the Substack, which provides a great answer for this. The first thing I just want to clarify in this question is the person says, am I looking for a freelance publicist or something else? I think this just speaks to the lack of awareness of like what people imagine publicist jobs to be. A publicist is not going to help with social media. That is, social media is technically a marketing job, not a publicity job. So I just wanted to be really clear about that. You know, a lot of this question depends, of course, on, you know, people's ability to financially float something like this, of course. But I do want to talk about a really great answer, which is the Substack that I pulled out for us today, which is called How to Market a Book You Haven't Written Yet. And this is from the Hype and Type Substack. And the person that wrote it, their handle is just Archetype, and they are in author marketing and design. And so it's a really great article. I'll link to it for you guys. And I think there's tons of things we can kind of pull out from this Substack, which I thought were really great. You know, one of the headings of this article is like, first, a reframe. You are not marketing nothing. That's the first thing that thought. To think about, you know, and then they get into some four content pillars and how to think about yourself as a brand and as a concept when you don't have a book yet, which I thought was really interesting as well. Cece, what stood out to you about this question and this article?
Such a good article. That's the first thing I want to say. Like, so well written, so full of protein, like very clear, very helpful. Highly recommend people read this. I love that at a certain point in the article, she says, like, there has to be a reframe, you know, there has to be a reframe. You're not supposed to be marketing a book that doesn't exist yet. Like, people think that's their job. And I actually think that was in the question we got, but that's not the job. Like, that's not the job. And then there's a really awesome pull quote, because I love a good analogy. So she said, this is the equivalent of opening a restaurant, getting it permitted and licensed, hanging a sign, and then standing in the doorway saying, I'm a chef for 2 years without serving any food. Meaning you don't have a book yet. Like you're not supposed to be marketing that book. And then I'm going to continue reading from the article. Eventually people walk past and stop noticing. Don't be an author without a book. Be the reader friend who happens to also be an author. And later in the article, she says, the leap from I trust your taste in books to I trust the book you wrote is much smaller than the leap from you're a stranger asking me to buy your debut to, okay, fine, here's my $30. And I love that she's highlighting this. I love that first she's like, just saying, no, you're not supposed to market a book that doesn't exist yet. And people think you are. A lot of people think you are. We get a lot of DMs about this. We hear a lot about it in, you know, chatter on social media. I need an audience, so I have to start marketing my book, but it's not even finished yet, or maybe I'm still querying, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you are not doing that. I love that she, right out the gate, debunked that. I also love that she talked about the pillars of what you should be doing instead in a very clear way. I don't know if you like that too. That was really good.
Yeah. I mean, this is the reason that I love this article is we get this question all the time, and authors, you know, aspiring authors think about this all the time, but they don't really know how to turn all of that energy into something. And what they're trying to do is just turn that energy into something. And that's where they just spin their wheels. And what I really liked about this was there's some actual factual information in this. So the first one being taste, right? Demonstrating that you have taste. Number two, process, but the sexy kind. Pillar three, your reading life. Pillar four, niche obsessions. And then it goes through like what not to do. Again, tons of great information. And the thing is, like, it's okay to make mistakes. And, you know, if you read this article and you're like, oh, I've done a bunch of things on it. Maybe this person says I'm not supposed to. It's okay. That's the beauty of social media, right? You just kind of like start fresh today, start fresh tomorrow, and keep kind of moving on. There's also a great section about like rebranding, right? How do you pivot an existing account to something else? Aspiring authors will often ask, do I need to like leave that other account behind, you know, for friends and family, kind of like Facebook style? And start a new like author account. I believe that you should pivot the one that you have. And this article goes into kind of explaining the pros and cons of both methods. But it is, I think, important just to like keep the fan base that you've had, scrub the account, move on from there. And this person offers some advice around that. But anyway, I think this is one of those articles that like you bookmark, you keep, you come back to, you know, if you're somebody who's aspiring or has signed a contract or announced a deal and you're like, what am I going to do for the next 2 years? This is just a really, really great read.
It's a wonderful read. And on the pillars, which again, probably one of my favorite part, I love that she talked first and foremost about taste. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because taste has always been an important part of our society, but now with AI and with the overwhelming amount of content that is frankly wishy-washy and has no strong perspective in the world, has no true insight. It's just like regurgitating what's already been said, or maybe like saying something that's kind of bland. Like having taste, having a strong point of view is very important. And the author of this article does say, do not disparage books, which I 100% agree with. Again, if you are a critic, that is a different story, but that's not your job, right? Like you are an author who's building a brand. So I think it's really awesome that she mentioned don't disparage books, but I will say that does not mean you love everything. You're not going to talk about the books you didn't love, but you are going to be true and authentic. Like if you're going to hype up a book, you better have loved that book. It has to be truly your taste. And when you hype it up, like share your unique perspective because that matters a lot. Like sharp perspective, a point of view is one of the most rare things these days. And I think it's really cool. I really loved that one, especially. I liked all the pillars. This is a great article.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So next we're going to answer some questions from readers. One of them is actually a really interesting question, which is why aren't there stats on what percentage of debuts die on sub? But before we get into that, we're going to hear from our sponsors.
Sponsors.
If you're like me and have travel coming up, whether it's a late spring break, summer vacations, weddings abroad, or international work trips, imagine arriving, actually understanding the language, ordering confidently at restaurants, connecting with locals at museums, feeling immersed instead of just visiting. We are headed to the Alps very soon with the kids and some friends of ours, and I can't wait to order my beer in German. Ein großes Bier, bitte. Okay, I need some work, but I will get there because Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language. No memorizing, random vocabulary lists, and no relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context. The way language is meant to be learned. My German will soon get better because of the true accent feature, which is designed to give real-time feedback on pronunciation. Lessons are simple to add to your regular schedule every day with the app or desktop fitted in, whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone helps you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey.
The best part about where I live is that when spring and summer comes, your outdoor space is an extension of your living space. When we moved in, we kept our deck the way it was, which meant that we needed to get creative about how to maximize its use. The layout was a bit wonky, but with Wayfair, you can find pieces that fit your outdoor space no matter what the size and dimensions. When you have the right pieces from Wayfair, your space fits your style and your budget. If you don't have an outdoor rug yet, you need to get one now. It frames your space and makes it feel like a living room and very intentional. You can bring your interior style design into your outdoor space, making it a seamless transition for hosting or just enjoying for yourself. If you haven't tried Wayfair yet, you're missing out on the experience of options that fit your space, style, and budget like no other. Outdoor seating, grills, major appliances, storage, patio lighting, rugs, decor. Wayfair is your one-stop shop for home. My favorite Wayfair feature is Wayfair Verified, your shortcut to the good stuff. Their team of product specialists vet everything by hand using a 10-point inspection, testing things like quality of materials, functionality and features, and even how long it takes to build. Take the guesswork out of ordering online and have complete confidence. Patio season is here and these deals won't last. Head to Wayfair.com right now to get your outdoor space ready for way less. That's Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
All right, Cece. So I had a couple questions come in, and both of these questions are actually from the same person, and I think they're really cheeky, interesting questions. So the first one I'll read out loud. Why aren't there stats on what percentage of debuts die on sub? Surely this is logged somewhere by agents and editors and then discussed when making offers. Or is it really all just it depends?
Surely this is logged somewhere by agents and editors. It's a big assumption. I don't think it's logged at all. Okay, so here's my thinking on this. I understand wanting stats, but stats mean nothing on an individual level. Mm-hmm. If I were to tell you that 60% of books on submissions by all agents in the US, okay, 60% sell and 40% don't sell, you would go into your book sale thinking, I have a 60% chance. No, you don't. Statistics mean nothing on an individual level. That is what that group got. Like, you either have 100 or 0, you know? It's a weird statistic thing, and there's actually a really good math book about this. Like, it's not a boring math book, it's a good math book, and I so wish I remembered the title. I mean, it's going to come to me and I will link it. But yeah, stats mean nothing. So if you want this because you want to know your chances, that is not how statistics work. The other thing is that we do not collectively log this. And in order to get a sense, because it can still be valuable even if not to determine your own chances, we don't collectively log this. Like, agents are not going around going to this centralized database and being like sending in their information. And editors are certainly not doing this as well. And then it's not all going to a centralized database where we can have this information. In order for us to tell you the stats, we would need information from everyone. And no, we're not doing this.
And also individually, like, those aren't the type of stats that I keep as a statistic. It's obviously information that I have as an agent when I have spreadsheets and I look at my spreadsheets. But at the end of the year, this isn't the type of data that I'm trying to parse through, because this data isn't actually that useful to me at all, because I'm always going for that 100% rate, as you said, right, Cece? So of course, not everything's going to work, but I don't decision make or pivot, or it doesn't inform any of my decision making based on what doesn't sell statistically. It might be a feeling that I have about, like, oh, this category has been really tough this year. Maybe I should sign another client in this category, knowing that, you know, XYZ, I'm still on sub with this. But that's kind of like informal intuition, I guess, right?
Yeah, especially because so much of an individual agent's numbers depend on factors that include but are not limited to, for example, how many big chances do they take? If they're the kind of agent who is signing on more memoirs, like, memoir is the hardest to sell, not talking about celebrity memoir. So that agent might, you know, have a different stat, but that's not a bad thing, you know, because if you're compared with an agent who is selling just the easier is such a ridiculous word to use, but the less difficult version to sell, like, it just changes so much. I do think it's important as agents for us to be always looking to, like, the books that I'm signing, am I finding the right editors for them? Editors who loved these books. Like, that's definitely something to keep track of. But editors cannot buy all the books they love. There just isn't enough space in their lists. So yeah, you're saying surely this is logged. It is not. I'm sorry. I know that's disappointing. I want to say this though, if someone can convince other agents to like send in stats anonymously, I will start logging. I do not do this, but I will start. If everyone's going to do it, I will do it for the sake of statistic, but not because it's going to give someone a sense of whether their book will sell, because I actually think that would be kind of cool, but that's not going to happen.
Talk about scope creep.
That is a pie in the sky.
Talk about scope creep of our job becoming data scientists now. About our own
industry. No, but I mean more like you know how the ALA asks us, like, how much money did you make this year? Yeah. Like, if the ALA were to ask agents, how many projects did you submit and how many did you sell? I'm not talking about, like, data scientists. Talking about, like, sharing that statistic anonymously. I would start tracking to answer. But, and this is a big but, it would only be useful if a huge number of people did it. You know?
Yes. And also, like, some things you go on sub in one calendar year and then you sell them the next calendar year. Like, how were we keeping this data, you know?
Yes. A lot of questions. And sometimes you're like, this didn't sell. And then it does sell 6 months later.
Yeah.
Because you got a surprise, you know, offer. Yeah.
Yes. And that leads into our next question. So we'll go there. Do agents have a gut feeling about a sub at a certain point? Like, if they're seeing the same rejections from editors for a manuscript and a certain amount of time has gone by, do they read the tea leaves, or is the process always surprising? So, and this was the reason that I kind of led into this from your answer, Cece, is that, like, sometimes things really do take a lot of time. It's not always that it's surprising, because I don't know if I wouldn't use the word surprise, because again, going back to like the 100% thing, like we sign projects and we pitch them because we want to sell them. And our goal is to sell things. So it's not like surprising to me when things do sell. Is it surprising when things don't? Sometimes it is. But again, I always have things in the back of my mind to pitch again, or if there's a new imprint kind of popping up, nothing's ever over for me. But in terms of like a gut feeling about a sub, when a certain amount of time has gone by and you are getting just the like stock rejection. Yeah. I mean, I would say how much time would I have to go by? Like 8 months maybe. And then just be like, you know, if it got to that point, I'd be like, okay, this is just a harder sell than I thought it was, you know? And then we figure out what we're going to do next. Yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That would be my answer, I guess. I don't know. Is that a good answer? What's your answer, Cece?
Yeah. No, it's a good answer. I think it's a both and situation. Like this person mentioned, if they are seeing the same rejections from editors. So this actually leads me to, you know, a lot of agents do this. Sometimes we'll go out on a smaller submission first, like to 7 or 8 editors, and see if there's like a, I don't know, like a common thread in case there are passes before we widen a little bit. Sometimes people do that, and that might happen with a book that's a little bit riskier. And by that, I just mean like maybe has a controversial topic. Maybe this book deals with themes that are a little bit harder. So that's something that's interesting, I think, to highlight. But yeah, I think it's both and, because sometimes I do notice a common thread. I'm thinking of one book. This is a fiction project of mine that didn't sell, by this incredibly talented author who is just like, she's such a strong writer. She's so smart. She's marketable. She's mediagenic. She's like the dream. Her book is not just dark. It has a dark ending, and the kind of dark ending that I have never seen in any kind of story. She and I actually did a deep dive on all the similar comps. We're talking TV shows. We're talking all the books, because we're like big readers, big consumers. And literally none of these books were as dark as her ending. None of them. This was back when the TV show Bad Sisters was trending. And this book involves killing a husband. And like the husband in that TV show is someone who our world is comfortable killing, because he is that bad. Like, spoiler alert, guys, but the man has done every bad thing you can imagine he has done, including the very, very, very bad thing. So you're comfortable with women getting revenge on this man because he's like such a heinous villain. But in this client's book, it was not. And before we even went out on sub, she and I talked about it. She and I were like, this is a huge risk. Could you change the ending? Sure. But she didn't want to. She had no interest in changing the ending. She didn't want to write because it was so integral to the story. And so when we went out on sub and we started seeing the rejections that were like, I read this till the end. I read this compulsively, but I just can't with this ending.
Yeah.
We were like not surprised because we talked about it, but we were doing what this person's asking, which is like kind of reading the tea leaves and kind of like pivoting and deciding what to do. I applaud authors who stand behind their vision. I do. I It makes my life harder as an agent. I don't mind. Yeah. I mean, that's not true. I mind, but I still want it, you know, because it is hard. But
yeah.
I applaud authors who are like, this is my editorial vision. This is what I want. I am going to stick with it. As long as you're doing it aware. What I don't want is for an author to be like, I had no idea this would be a problem. I'm so surprised. No, we've talked about it. We talked about the risks. We talked about what could, you know, what could make editors say yes and what could make editors say no. And it is no one's job to eliminate all the no's because that just makes a terrible book. That makes for a bland book. It's your job to know where you stand in the high risk or not spectrum of things.
Yeah, no, that's a really great and valid example. Yeah, our job's hard, Cece.
Our job is hard. You make it look easy.
Oh, thank you. Well, I always love chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time today. And yeah, we have lots of fun stuff to talk about again next week. And we haven't said who our big reveal is of our first guest on our Monday episodes yet. Have we dropped the name?
I don't think we have. I think we teased it, right? I don't remember. We should be more organized.
We should. We're very organized in our day jobs.
But guys, our jobs are hard. This is why we're not organized on the pod. Okay. Do you know why we're not organized here? Because Bianca's not here. Because it's you and me.
I know.
Because the kids are playing. You know, the kids are playing.
Yes.
You let the kids loose.
We're having fun. Yeah. So no, I think we teased it. We said, you're going to know this person. You're going to be excited. And yeah, it's coming up really soon. We're going to record with them next week. And I'm really excited. And they are going to do the inaugural version of like the rant, the guest rant.
Yeah.
They're going to come on and give their rant. And we previewed some of the ideas they're thinking about ranting about. And we know you guys are going to love it. So stay tuned for lots of fun stuff coming up this summer. Thanks for hanging out with us. And we'll see you guys soon.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, my story gets better in chapter 2. I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter 2. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.